Hello and welcome to Inside Education with me, Sean Delaney. Each week on Inside Education, I interview an educator who has interesting ideas about teaching or the wider world of education. To access podcasts of hundreds of previous Inside Education programmes, you can go to seandelaney.com/podcasts. Whatever your interest in education, you'll find interesting material, I think, for professional development there. On this week's programme, I speak to the author of Irish Education 1922 to 2007, Cherishing All the Children. Brian Fleming retired from his teaching position in 2009, having spent 25 years as principal of Collinstown Park Community College in Clondalkin, County Dublin. Since then, he has completed a doctorate in education and has undertaken research into the topic of equality of opportunity in Irish education. When I met up with Brian, I first asked him what the book was about.
Well, it's really looking at the policy followed by successive governments in relation to disadvantaged pupils, and a particular group of disadvantaged pupils, those who poverty is the main issue. I wasn't looking at disadvantage from the point of view of special needs or anything like that. So 1922 to 2007, I had to put an end date on it sometime, and it struck me 2007 was the height of the boom. So if we were doing things properly, we should have been doing them properly in 2007. Afraid we weren't.
And we'll get back into tracing that journey in just a moment. How did you go about writing the book?
Well, I spent 25 years of my life as principal of a school in a disadvantaged area, and I learned a lot along the road, and the issue sort of drove me down and still drives me. So when I retired, I decided to do a PhD, and I found myself under the tutelage of a wonderful woman, Judith Harford at UCD, a very young woman. And she dragged me by the scruff of the neck through a PhD, and it was on the topic of educational disadvantage.
That's an interesting decision, because most people would do a PhD while they're still working, but you took it on as a project after you retired.
Tell you the truth, now, there were a lot of people in the group that I was in that were working full time. The job of a principal in a disadvantaged school, if I say it's harder, a lot of my friends will fall out with me. But a disadvantaged school can be very volatile. Now, I actually think it's harder, but I can't prove that. But it's very volatile. A lady called Ruth Lupton over in England has done a lot of research on this. And really taking on a PhD in that situation wasn't a runner for me.
And what is it about being a principal in a disadvantaged school that does make it challenging?
The kids, really. You know, you can go in first thing in the morning with the plans to do X, Y and Z, and suddenly there could be anything. Could be a row in the community the night before. Now, I don't want to give the impression that was always the case. Could be a very severe family problem. Could be self-harm. Could be anything. I suppose the thing about it was you didn't know when it was going to erupt. It could be there waiting for you at 9 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes it was there when I was trying to come home at 5 o'clock in the evening. There was a problem. You know, kid wouldn't go home because of difficulty with his dad. So here I am at 5 o'clock. So it's that sort of unevenness that meant that, you know, I had great staff, absolutely fabulous staff, but you could never really say, well, I'm going to take on something else as well.
So you decided to do the PhD. Yeah. Was it hard to find the topic you were going to work on?
No, because I knew what the topic was. I'm still fascinated by the topic. So I had no problem with that, was trying to find a supervisor. I mean, the thing about doing a PhD when you're in retirement, if it's not working out, and the relationship with the supervisor would be important. I mean, I could have walked away at any stage. I wasn't building a CV. So, you know, you need to find the supervisor that you're compatible with, really.
What does the book have to say about, say, for example, the Department of Education and Skills? Because they're obviously a key partner or a key stakeholder in education.
I did a big range of interviews, 30-something interviews, and really the book says what people said to me. And these included former ministers for education, former senior officials.
You interviewed these people?
Oh, I did. Current officials. One Taoiseach, John Bruton, who had been a minister in that department, Minister of State in the early 70s. Noel Dempsey, people like that. I interviewed senior officials, Don Thornhill and so on. What it said to me and what they said to me was that there's a lot of hard-working, very decent people in there, but the culture is a doubtful process in the sense that it was always nearly on the periphery of running the education system. It probably still is. So they were giving money to religious bodies or whoever to run schools. It was never a powerful department. And in the political arena, it's a junior position. I mean, it's a position that's filled by ministers either on the way up or the way down. And there's plenty of examples of that. It shouldn't be that way because, I mean, think of all the kids that are depending on it and adults going to adult education and so on. But I think it's the whole history of the Department of Education and the fact that it was really only facilitating what other groups were doing.
So where then is the power in education?
Well, it's changing, but a lot of people would have said to me that the power now, the church is going down, obviously. The department is still there, the teacher unions now. And that's not to criticise them. That's where the power is. If you look at the dispute over junior cycle reform, the department and the NCCA had a proposal to put. It was supported by all the other partners, the parent bodies, the student body, the National Association of Principals and Deputy Principals, so on and so forth, and opposed by the unions. So it didn't happen.
And you're saying that has changed. So you looked at the period from 1922 to 2007. Over that time, how has the role and the power of unions evolved?
Well, the unions have become more powerful. I mean, really the church called the shots. I looked at it in three phases, 22 to 59, 59 to about 80 and 81 then to 2007. In the first phase, the church ran it. The stairs up to the minister's office was known as the bishop's stairs. It's a joke, but it's a reality. They ran it for that period. Lamass in 59-60, I'm not sure he was ever really interested in education, but he reckoned the education system needed to be reformed for economic reasons. And he got stuck into it near the succession of ministers, notably Hillary and O'Malley. So they grabbed the reins, shall we say, in the 60s, and they began to make policy, and they pushed, you know, they pushed the hierarchy a little bit, and they pushed this one and that one, and they brought in reforms, as we know. And then they sort of, it reverted back. It had its moment in the limelight, and then it reverted back to church still powerful, unions becoming more powerful as the 70s and 80s went on, parents not really a power body in it. And that's still going on, I'd say. You know, there's movement. It's not static, but it's still going on.
So did that show that a powerful minister could actually exert influence rather than allowing the department to be kept to one side? Like, I mean, if you're talking about the likes of, say, Patrick Hillary and Donna O'Malley.
It showed they could do that, powerful personalities, if they had the backing of the Taoiseach all the way and if it was a priority for government. The minute Lamass retired and Donna O'Malley died shortly afterwards, it were down the slope again. I mean, if you look back at the Taoiseach we've had since then, other than Garrett Fitzgerald, and he was in when there was no money anyway, but you can't say to yourself that Bertie Ahern or Albert Reynolds or Charlie Haughey were really interested in education, or certainly not that much interested in educational disadvantage. And that's understandable. I mean, governments have priorities. They'll never say, a government minister will never say something's not a priority, but within their own heads are our priorities.
And parents, have parents become more powerful? Because at least they have a collective organisation since the 1980s and Gemma Hussey's time, I think.
Yes, Gemma brought that in. I don't know if they're more powerful. I mean, I interviewed one of the parent representatives, and essentially it's manned by volunteers. So you're active in the National Parents Council while your children are in post-primary school. And then you're finished and you're gone, somebody else comes on. Whereas if you look at the teacher unions, you have a permanent general secretary there that's probably there, you know, a fellow like Jim Dorney in the TUI was, I think Jim was there about 25 years, maybe more. And now, okay, you have a new president every second year or whatever it is, but you have a continuum of understanding contacts and how to go about getting things done. So it's going to be very difficult for a body like the National Parents Council ever to compete with that.
And if you look at the period you looked at and your concern was equality of educational opportunity, how did that change over those 70, 80 years?
Well, I suppose we got a better understanding. I mean, the first notion was, well, if you open the schools, that's grand, that's the problem solved. And we gradually realised that that wasn't just the solution. And we're getting better now. We're diagnosing particular needs, and if things like autism units in schools and so on. So we are getting better. But there are still a lot of kids falling out of the system. A lot of kids not completing to leaving certificate. The rates of progression to third level, well, you know, they're scandalous in many ways if you compare Dublin 4 or Dublin 6 with Dublin 15 or wherever. Equality of opportunity is sort of a low standard. It means more than that. I mean, just saying, well, there it is, that's not enough.
What would it take in an ideal world to bring about equality of educational opportunity? Who has to do what?
Society has to. Ministers and governments will go where society wants them to go. Okay, you'll have an exceptional guy that'll drag society in a direction maybe it hadn't realised it wanted to go. But society has to want it. And I think this was a sort of a sad conclusion I reached, that a lot of us are happy with the education system if it's looking after our own kids, or in my case, our own grandchildren, well, and maybe the next door neighbour. But we're not really worried that much if kids in a very disadvantaged area aren't getting a great service. It's the whole thing in public services. Okay, we all want better public services, but then when somebody talks about raising the income tax, we're all very angry. So, you know.
So the people who need to do something then, I think this is what you're saying, don't have a loud enough voice.
Well, the people who are being failed by the system definitely have very little political clout. They're not the sort of people that end up by and large as ministers for education or government ministers of any sort or senior civil servants or whatever. Society has to want this to happen. If we want really quality of opportunity, the whole of society needs to want it.
But doesn't society need leadership, and it needs somebody to have a vision that it can follow?
Yes, and people will follow a vision, but when you start to say, well, this is going to cost us, how far will they go? But certainly, I mean, there's no doubt, if you got a really charismatic minister or Taoiseach who was really interested in this issue, it would make a difference, yeah.
And of the initiatives that you looked at over the period you were studying, was there anything that did make a tangible difference?
Absolutely, a lot of them made a difference. I mean, the O'Malley thing obviously made a difference.
That was free secondary education.
Yeah, we've had a thing called the DESH scheme in post-primary and primary schools now that's directed at disadvantage. So these all make a difference. If you put that in the context that most people go through the education system once, you'd wonder though. A lot of kids, if they fail in the system now, no matter all the things we've developed, if they fail, they drop out and they're never going back. So there is a lot of extra money being pointed towards disadvantage, but it's just not enough.
Is it just money? Like, say, for example, could teachers in schools or principals, can they do more for advancing equality of educational opportunity?
Well, there's nothing like a good teacher. You can probably remember, I can remember a teacher that left a mark, not a literal mark on me, by the way he went about his job. But there was a notion floated maybe 10, 15 years ago that teachers in disadvantaged areas would be treated differently by way of maybe less teaching hours than the norm, by way of being allowed to take a sabbatical. That disappeared off the horizon. So a system whereby you could encourage the best teachers to come into the areas that they're most needed in. I know if you talk about a different salary scale, you're going to get into all sorts of trouble, but some way of supporting them. The most important thing in the school is what happens in the classroom. After all is said and done, what the principal does is great and all the rest of it. What happens in the classroom is the thing.
As long as the children are turning up to the classroom.
Well, there are issues there. There's a whole big issue about school attendance. A lot of kids who are on the books of schools are sort of disengaged. Their attendance is so erratic that they're disengaged. And this can disadvantage other pupils. You know, if you're teaching a class of history or whatever, and there's a sort of a regular turnover of who's in front of you, even the kid who's attending every day, he's losing out, or she's losing out, because the teacher has to keep going back. So attendance is a big issue, and we haven't really attacked that properly at all.
The title of your book comes from the 1916 proclamation.
Yes.
How would you characterise the educational provisions of the 1937 constitution?
You can't go back and look at it through the 2017 eyes. You have to understand what was going on then. But there is no doubt that the fact that De Valera, it seems, put in the word "for," he put it in himself, in the phrase that says the state should provide for education. So we have a state-aided system. That really took the state out of it to a degree, except you pay the bills. So we have a very strange education system. I mean, you know, you'd be aware of the case of Louise O'Keefe and the European Court, and where she was abused by a school principal. And the state took the view, well, the principal was employed by the Board of Management, so they had nothing to do with it, even though they were paying his salary, and the European Court blew that out of the water. But it does leave us with a strange system. It always strikes me as odd that the Minister for Education will come on the airwaves, usually in February, to say the department has built 20 schools, and then he'll give a list of private institutions that he's going to hand them over to. And then he'll spend the rest of the time bringing in legislation, controlling admissions and all sorts of things, because the schools are doing things that he doesn't like or are really indefensible in some ways. Or you had strange things like Rory Quinn pleading with schools not to go for dear uniforms and so on. But these are schools we built as a state, as a taxpayer. These are schools staffed by people we pay. And here he is pleading with private institutions to do what we would all like to see them doing. So it is a very odd system.
But then I suppose the religious institutions would have put in a certain amount of their own money or their own land into these as well. So that complicates it even more.
They did in their time, and that has to be acknowledged, absolutely. And I mean, there were whole areas and whole generations that wouldn't have got education, certainly at second level, but for the religious institutions. And I mean, it should not be forgotten. But we are in 2017 now, and it's still going on. And you have new bodies being formed, like Educate Together. So they're given their share of schools, and that's a private institution. I just wonder, should the state be spending the money building these schools, paying the staff, and then handing them over to private institutions? It just doesn't add up to me. It's the old story of the fella asking for directions, and somebody said, well, if I was going to such a place, I wouldn't start from here. This is where we are, but we have to sort of address this in some way.
And you have to start somewhere.
And you have to start somewhere, yeah. I've just finished writing a book on the foundation years of Irish primary education and the 1831 Act and the Stanley Letter. And I think possibly the answer to the whole patronage issue is in there somewhere. And I'm interested that in the Irish Times a few weeks ago, where they interviewed some of the more notable educationalists over the years, John Coolan and so on and so forth. But Anya Hyland said that's where the solution is as well. The difference is, in those days, there were different religions fighting for control. Now we have sort of a group of religions on one side and a group of what I'll call non-religionists on the other side fighting for control. There must be a solution there somewhere that could solve it in 1831. Should be able to solve it now.
What impact did the Education Act of 1998 have on tackling equality of educational opportunity?
It nearly had a big effect. I'll put it to you that way. It had some effect. But one of the most interesting elements of that was that there was, in the draft bill, there was a phrase that the Minister for Education may appoint an educational disadvantage committee. And in the course of the debate, that may was changed to shall. So he has to appoint it. The specification was interesting because usually committees in Irish education are all the usual suspects. This group has a representative, that group has a representative, and you know, and that's grand. This was more of an expert committee. From memory, it specified that at least half were sort of outside experts. They weren't there to represent anyone. Or you could say they were there to represent everyone, particularly the children. So it took a couple of years to get that up and running, and it was formed in 2002. Anya Hyland was the chairperson, and it produced some very interesting research and proposals. And it was a source of hope to people like myself working out in the field that here was a group that, well, for somebody like Anya knows what she's talking about, but the group knew what it was talking about and was looking at different possibilities and so on. Their term of office was 3 years. In 2005, the term of office came to an end and they were never replaced, even though, by law, the Minister for Education was obliged to have an educational disadvantage committee. That drifted on for a few years, and then the old story of don't waste a recession. Sean Haughey was a junior minister in education at the time. He announced, I think about 2008 or 9, that it would not be replaced because of financial circumstances. Now, the Education Disadvantage Committee costs 50,000 a year. I know the recession was rough, but 50,000 wasn't going to make any difference. The obligation to have one was included in legislation, I forget what act it was, in 2012. So although it hadn't existed for 7 years, from 2005 to 2012, there was an obligation for 7 years to have one, and the removal of the obligation to have one went through the Oireachtas without anyone expressing any concern. I find that whole thing sad because it's a classic yes minister, you know.
So the situation now is that there is no requirement to have a committee on educational disadvantage.
Yeah, there is no requirement. And it looked to me like a Sir Humphrey Appleby effort that the department nobbled the education disadvantage committee, or the fact that there should be one.
And under which minister was that? Was that under Rory Quinn?
In 2005, Rory abolished it, which surprised me. And John Walsh was there, the education correspondent, who would have, you know, have a fair understanding of educational disadvantage. 2005, it wasn't replaced. I'd say that's Mary Hanifin. I'm not, wouldn't be sure of that now. I'd have to look back. But I think I can't say a decision not to replace, but it wasn't replaced, shall we say, I think was probably under her term of office. I find that sort of, it's a sign of a department afraid of expertise or something, unless it's their own expertise. Now, Quinn justified it on the grounds that the DESH plan had come in and this will be monitored by the Education Research Centre. That's not the same as having a statutory committee that's independent, chaired by somebody like on the island. It's completely different. I mean, the Education Research Centre has a good track record and I'm sure integrity and all the rest. Them supplying reports to the department isn't the same as a statutory education disadvantage committee.
What sources did you draw on in writing the book?
Sources were interviews, 33 from memory, of people who had been directly involved, as I described earlier, former ministers, former senior officials, former trade union officials, representatives of the National Parents Council, primary, post-primary, a few academics, Kathleen Lynch and people like that. And then the usual sources when you're researching history, you know, the newspapers of the day and the various publications produced by the Department of Education and everyone else over the period. I looked, coming back to the Constitution, I looked at the Constitution Review Group that was established, I think maybe 95 or 96. That was sort of disappointing. Kathleen Lynch was on that and she ploughed a furrow for sort of serious reform, but it was dominated by legal people whose understanding of educational disadvantage is probably not great.
If you were to begin your career again with a view to promoting equality, what role would you aspire to have the most influence? You can have any role in the education system. What would you aspire to?
It's with a limited group, but a school principal is it's a great position to be in if you want to help people, absolutely, and if you have the right people with you. Nobody ever asked me to be Minister for Education. I have a feeling that department might drive me batty, so maybe I was better off in a school.
We're coming near the end, so I have a few general questions. Who or what inspires you?
I spent the last few days sitting on a board that was assessing applications for funding from groups that are tackling educational disadvantage. And I met a lot of inspiring people. You know, people that are working at the coalface, I should say none of these were in schools, they were on in alternative operations. And there's people doing great work. And then there are people I worked with or other principals I would know who are working in very disadvantaged areas. And I would know well that the odds are stacked against any such school. So seeing somebody going in every day, facing stacked odds, and just getting on with it, that's very inspiring.
Have you a favourite writer or book or blog about education?
Michael Fullan, Alma Harris maybe, Ruth Lupton I mentioned already. You know, in the Irish scene, John Coolan and Ollie Highland are always worth listening to. Kathleen Lynch delivers a message, I suppose I'm predisposed to what she's saying. There are plenty of people I'd follow and I still follow even though I'm retired, yeah.
Alma Harris, I don't know her. What did she write?
Alma's leadership is her issue, not specifically disadvantage. And I suppose that was a secondary issue for me, being in the job for so long. I was lucky enough to be in a small group that spent 3 days with him way back. And, you know, it's one thing to read a book, but it's another thing for an intensive 3-day course with a fellow like that. And he'd come away now ready to charge off windmills after a session like that.
If you could make one change to the school you were last in, and if resources were not an issue, what change would you make?
Well, when the country had money, you'll remember that we spent our time reducing the pupil-teacher ratio at second level. It went from 20 to 1 to gradually to 19 to 1, and then I think 18 and a half to 1 at some stage. There's very little evidence that any of that makes any difference. But there is evidence that if you make a big change in class sizes, you make a difference. A fellow called John Hattie has written a lot about that. I suppose if I could have made really small classes, and when I'm talking about really small, I'm talking about less than 15. I suppose that's one thing. The other thing, I suppose, that, you know, I was working at second level, but to a degree you're chasing your tail. Early intervention, I know it's a cliche, but early intervention pays off, and the preschool provision that's now coming in, I mean, that should have come in years ago. And I think that'll work its way through primary and so on. So I suppose I would have liked to see early intervention earlier in my career, but it's coming now.
What from your own primary or post-primary education informed your own practice in education?
One of my teachers at primary level was my father, and I know that's not a good idea. It wasn't good for him, God rest him, and maybe not good for me. I suppose the relationship, a good teacher, and I had some good and some not so good. It seems to me that a good teacher is somebody that loves his subject and loves children or young people. And as I look back, the people I remember were the teachers who were got on well with you, could have a laugh with you, but knew where the line was. The over-strict ones weren't great, and the ones who had no control, they're no use to anyone. And as I look back at teachers I worked with, I never really found a lack of knowledge of their subject to be a problem. It was the other issues, class control, how to get on with kids, how to establish a relationship, that sort of thing.
For someone who's interested in reading your book, Brian, how can they go about getting a copy of it?
It's through a website, www.educationhistory.ie, €20 plus postage package. Great value, I have to say.
And for anyone interested in the history of educational opportunity in Ireland, who could disagree? That's all we have time for on this week's programme. Remember, you can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on seandelaney.com or on iTunes. Brian Fleming's book is titled Irish Education 1922-2007, Cherishing All the Children, and is available from educationhistory.ie. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, which is published by Routledge, is now available online from the Routledge website or from any online bookseller. You can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest, Brian Fleming. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.